Now, initially, the density, the number density is too low to give you any reaction. So that initially, gravity has to do it. And the way gravity works is you have collisions between these particles, which slows down their orbital velocities around the common center and converts it into heat. And eventually, that slowing down leads to a contraction. So the rate is initially zero, but then as the density increases, this quantity, it finally begins to rise. And as it rises, it goes faster because the temperature is improving. And so you get a nice reaction that then goes bubbling along. Now, you can actually put in the numbers, you know, using the gravitational constant and the mass of the sun, the size of the sun, and so on, and determine what kind of a, just converting the gravitational energy into temperature using the heat capacity, you get 2 kilovolts, which is what you need to get the reaction started. Now, however, as this reaction proceeds, here is the sun, and the reaction is really only going on in the little core here, the very hottest part. And eventually, what's happening is overall, you get 4 protons getting converted into helium, plus any number of neutrinos. And there's some charge that gets. There are electrons also that come in here. Don't worry about that. The point is that the products occupy a lesser volume and, moreover, are not burnable at that temperature. All right? So you have this furnace going on, and the ashes are collected in the middle. And before you can get new fuel in, you've got to take those ashes out. So it waits for some kind of radial circulation to bring new fuel in. And this is the part that the astrophysicists don't pay any attention to, apparently. They have that core sitting there cooking forever, but you can't do that. Now, what I claim is the reason for the missing neutrinos is that the sun's gone out. That ought to make headlines. But let me persuade you that it could happen. First of all, I told you why it happened. It's because you haven't removed the ashes. Mm-hmm. But that it can happen and you not notice works in the following way. In the sun, the sun's given that diameter, it takes about 1 million years for a photon to diffuse out. So when we look at the outside temperature and calculate the rate of energy radiation, that's a reflection of what happened 1 million years ago in the interior of the sun, and not necessarily what's going on now, right? Mm-hmm. So the sun could go out and you wouldn't know it. Now, this phenomenon of the vertical circulation is a highly nonlinear thing. And like many of the hydrodynamic aspects, it's an instability. Now, let me talk about something more familiar, the atmosphere of the Earth. We know that if you had a perfectly isentropic atmosphere, that would have a certain temperature gradient, and you could take a parcel of air from here and put it up there, and it would still be in equilibrium because it expands as it cools, but it reaches a region that has the same properties. Mm-hmm. If you want vertical circulation, then what you need is a situation where when you take this parcel there at this altitude and you elevate it and it expands, it's still hotter than the environs, so it continues to rise.
so it's an automatic circulation. Otherwise, you elevate it, and it's colder than the surroundings, it's denser, and then it subsides, so it goes clunk. And we have that situation here in Los Angeles Basin all the time. Now, what I'm saying is that as this fire goes out, see, what's happening is that this is declining because it's being burned up. This may rise for a while to keep up, and the reaction stays high because the temperature is rising. But eventually, if you run out of fuel, there's nothing you can do about it. So now the reaction comes to a halt. Mm-hmm. And there are no more photons being produced, but contraction will raise the temperature. Right? Now, during that contraction process, what I believe happens is that whereas this was in a stable configuration, in other words, no vertical circulation, the analog that I was just talking about where you elevate a parcel and it subsides. But with a continued contraction and a change in the temperature distribution, it goes unstable. And then you have circulation that brings in more fuel, and the reaction starts up again. So I envisage this thing going like this, you know, and then it sort of tapers off and goes down here. And then maybe at some later time it does that. But this time is not uniform. It's not a periodic thing because it's an instability that's triggered by this behavior. So I say, sure, the neutrinos are missing. That's because the sun's gone out. But I talk to the astrophysicists about this, and I get nowhere. They don't have any answer, except that it's not the standard model.
Well, does that come back to your earlier comment about academic scientists?
Yeah. This has application, incidentally, also to what I call the autogenesis of smog. Not making a pun about the creation of the smog by automobiles, but it goes this way. The people talk about inversion as though that's a rare event. They don't know is that every night on every place, every land area, there's an inversion. It happens because the land is a good radiator and the air isn't. And so the air that's close to the land and communicating with it thermally gets cold. And you might start out, you know, at noon with a nice plotting this as the temperature is a function of altitude. Maybe I better make it the other way around. Altitude is a function of temperature. The temperature is high near the ground and falls off with altitude. But at night, what happens is you don't affect the temperature at altitude much because the air is a lousy radiator. But down here, you have this kind of behavior. Now, the sun comes up, warms the land, and it causes that foot to move out. And then, but if there's dust or absorbers in the atmosphere, another thing happens. Namely, it doesn't take very much dust because the air has low heat capacity, and pretty soon you have this kind of a thing develop. So by putting smog in the air, you create more smog, because the smog is held close to the ground. See, the way the air is cleansed is, on the one hand, by washing things out, and on the other, by having the winds blow this junk over Arizona, where, at a given time, it gets chewed up by the atmosphere. So the
cure for this, you know, insofar as the automobiles produce the smog, have everybody get up late, you know. And it turns out that on weekends, on Sundays when people sleep late, the air tends to be a lot cleaner. Well, those are some of the other the other things. I wanted to give you this. Since 1971, I've had this in business, and we've done quite a few things that don't appear in that.
Oh, okay.
Which give you a feeling for it.
Excellent, because I wanted to ask you how McMillan the Science Associates came about.
Well,
I don't know if this is, we might as well do that now.
Sure. that happened in 1971. The physics department at RAND got very disenchanted with RAND management. The physics department was essentially self-supporting with these outside contracts. And RAND skimmed off, the management skimmed off the overhead. Mm-hmm. And so there was no funding for recruiting, you know, all the standard things that you want to do running a business. So they decided to form their own corporation, which they did, which came to be called RDA. And so it's been going for 20 years. I didn't want to go with that for a variety of reasons. First, I just gotten back from Vietnam, and the RAND Physics Department had been mainly concerned with strategic nuclear things. And I saw that that field was pretty well covered, but that the tactical arena badly needed some help. So I thought, here's maybe a place to contribute. And anyway, I started up this business and been wrestling with that ever since.
You still, most of your work is in, I just looked at this, most of your work is still government-related work then?
Well, it's getting away from that for the reason that the government very hard to work with. They've become impossible. We have auditors and inspectors swarming over the place all the time, taking up everybody's time. Totally useless from my point of view. You know, we're a small outfit. We're not spending millions of dollars. And yet the government, I'm sure, spends millions of dollars auditing us.
Do you have other people working here with you?
Well, we're down pretty well now. There are only three or four of us here for the most part. We were up to about 20 at one point, but that was when we had some business.
Have you always been at this location?
Yeah, essentially. But it's getting so it's more and more difficult to stay afloat. I'm planning to build a house and move out.
What about the RAND physicists? How does their group do?
Oh, they've done very well. They recently sold out to Logicon and made a pot of money.
Are there any other small groups like yours? Involved with government projects?
Oh, yeah, there are quite a few small groups around. But what we do mainly is is operations analysis for a variety of things. You know, that's just kind of an analytic, careful thinking. The sort of thing that I described here on the bombing of the mm-hmm. artillery sites.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's room for that in industry. We've got a small contract with one of the big corporations. This corporation, I don't want to give you too much detail, but they have a fleet of aircraft that handles a lot of their travel. And the question comes, you know, they got enough aircraft, do they need more of what? So here's a little analysis of what happened in October and November of last year, which gives the number of days in which they had zero requests for charter flights, and up to seven requests. This is the spectrum. That spectrum is shown here in the bar graph, and you can fit it with a theory in which which is developed from scratch and uses only the average number, the n bar. Here is the probability. Then when you fold that in with the availability of the aircraft, taking into account 13 or so percent maintenance, you can calculate how many of their requests could be fulfilled. And here it is. The theory gives 93, and the actual was 95, pretty close. And so that tells them that they can't get rid of one of those aircraft. It's kind of amusing that you know, you can do that with air precision.
Yes, that's
we've also done quite a bit of work with industry that themselves have military contracts. For example, with Hughes, they developed a wonderful radar for backtracking shells called the TPQ-37. Somebody shooting at you and you want to know where the origin is. And with that, they can see a 155 millimeter shell at a distance of 30 kilometers and tell you where it came from. It's pretty damn good. One of the things we did was to point out that it's much easier to see large missiles. You can see them at much greater distance. So if you have scuds coming at you, you can locate where the origin is. But again, you know, it always involves quite a bit of mathematical detail, and you have to know something about missile flight characteristics and things of that sort.
There's some controversy right now about the Patriot effectiveness.
Yes, whether it really was as effective as claimed, yeah.
Do you have any opinions on it?
I haven't looked at the data.
Let me go back, and some other things I wanted to ask you about in some of your early scientific papers. We think we've covered a good deal of this, but you did a paper in 57 on the determination of rate constant ratios and competitive second order reactions, standard physical chemistry kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you had an acknowledgement of Donald J. Cram for.
Yeah. Well, he came to me with that problem.
Okay.
And I worked it out. That funny thing happened there. I got a very irate letter from some guy in Sweden saying that he'd done all this before and published in some obscure Swedish journal. I'm sorry about that.
Jack Roberts said he had a sabbatical at Caltech, and I don't have the right time frame. One of the reasons he took that sabbatical at Caltech is that he wanted to be close to you.
My goodness.
Because you had gotten him into molecular orbital theory.
Yes. Yes. He describes that in his autobiography. Have you seen that?
Yes.
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 Volume.
Mm-hmm.
What happened was, this was in 1951, when I was teaching for a year at Harvard, and he was at MIT. The way he tells the story from his side is, he had he was going to teach a course in organic, in physical organic chemistry, and he had promised to do this by molecular orbital theory, figuring that he would read Dewar or whoever and get up on it, but he didn't know a damn thing about it. So he came to me with his, you know, typical Roberts approach, you got to teach me this stuff. And so I spent quite a bit of time with him, showing him how to, you know, what the quantum mechanics was about and how to use the group theory and so on. And then he really seized the ball and ran with it. Did some very nice work.
Yes.
But most of that interaction happened back east. It wasn't.
Okay.
I don't understand the Caltech connection.
Well, they may have not been totally related, but he did say that, you know, he was commenting about your close friendship and being close to you, because you were UCLA.
Mm-hmm.
So
we haven't really interacted a whole heck of a lot. Both very busy.
You also had a had your name on a paper with Saul Weinstein.
Yes. Yes.
Shades of your work with Louis Hammett that never existed.
Well, except that this was a quantum mechanical calculation. It was my contribution to it. Saul had a student, PhD student, who had done some quantum mechanical calculations that I kibitzed on with.
You became chairman in 1959.
Yeah.
And you commented earlier that much of that was really part-time or so on.
Mm-hmm.
How would you characterize the state of the department in, when you became chair?
Well, I have to go back in time a little bit. Bill Young had been chairman until, I guess, about 1948. And then moved over into the central administration, where he was responsible for the campus development program. And he was succeeded by Francis Blasé as chairman. And he went until about, I guess, for half a dozen years. Don't quote me on that. And then he became Dean of Physical Sciences. And at that point, he came and twisted my arm to become chairman. Now, of course, the department had by this time a good PhD program going. 1959 had been in operation now nearly 20 years. But it was a sort of a one-horse operation. That is, there was one departmental secretary. If you wanted to get anything typed, you had to take it over to Central Steno across the campus. There was a guy in charge of the laboratory who was utter incompetent and was almost never there and totally useless. There was a girl in the business office who really did his job, very competent woman, and that was about it. You know, we didn't have any kind of reproduction facilities. there was a machine shop. There was no electronic shop, no computer business. So it was rather a primitive thing that needed to be brought into the modern view. So I took this job with the proviso that we get a guy who had been an ex-student of mine, a PhD student, who was then teaching at Stanford, to come and be my vice chair. It was the first time there was a vice chairman. So that there were two of us interacting there. And we turned things around. It was a big effort. We got Bill Libby to come join us. And that was something of a coup.
Of course, you had some long-standing connections with him, too.
Yes.
Which I'm sure helped.
Right. Very good friends. And we were able to get quite a bit of support from the administration. We had to fight for everything, but I got secretaries scattered around, like one secretary for three faculty members, scattered throughout the building. We reorganized the business office. I fired that bum and got a new laboratory director who was a crackerjack. He's just retired, unfortunately. Russ counted up one time and said that we had fired 57 people. I don't know what kind of index that is, but when I left, boy, it was a humming organization. There were no bums in it. We had an electronics shop. We had an instrumentation shop. Being lots of instruments to cope with. We had, of course, the machine shop. We had our own liquid air, liquid nitrogen production facility due to the help that Willie gave us. We had our own reproduction facility at that point. Boy, it just made life a hell of a lot simpler. So you could spend time on research. You didn't have to worry about all these damn details.
Did the what about the graduate program? You said it was well established, 20 years old at that time. Did it grow any? Did this bring in more graduates?
It has continued to grow. And of course, what really grew was the postdoctoral aspect. But there was another thing. I mentioned the golden years, so to speak, that we had when we were undergraduates, Jack and I.
Mm-hmm.
And what I did was to reestablish that. I put in an office of undergraduate advising as well as an office for graduate advisors. Those two still exist. And there are all kinds of things going, you know, a rogue picture gallery of the students at one point when I was teaching one of the PCHEM courses and summer was coming up, and I had a particularly good class of able students, many of whom would like to do research. So I went around and I put the arm on a lot of my colleagues for a little bit of research money. Not that they gave it to me, but they promised to hire students in the summer. Well, one of the guys involved in that was a fellow named John Seach, who later joined the NSF. And he was the guy who established their undergraduate research program based on that. So it was long range effects.
Yes.